funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
My grandmother was a bit of a maverick. She grew up in this little town in Ohio, but she had big dreams. She went to college to earn a nursing degree so she could apply for what in the 1930s was an enviable job, airline flight attendant. She loved being a career gal, as she called it. She made friends, got to travel, and had her own money to spend at the height of the Depression. Until, that is, she got engaged. The deal with the airline was pretty straightforward. Its female flight attendants had to meet strict height and weight guidelines, ostensibly for safety, really for glamour, and they had to be single. Tie the knot, and the company cut you loose. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My grandmother chose to get married, but she would not have quit her job if she hadn't been forced out. But this was 1940, and it wasn't until 1964 that the Civil Rights Act outlawed workplace discrimination on the basis of sex. As my guest will tell us, women's rights were tossed into the measure almost as a joke, but the joke was on anyone who underestimated the resolve of American women to claim their full and equal rights. Jillian Thomas is senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. Her new book is called Because of Sex: One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Jillian, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'll confess, I didn't know who added the language to the Civil Rights Bill that explicitly prohibited discrimination on the basis of sex. I never would have guessed it would be a guy like Howard Smith.
Yeah, it definitely is a surprise to a lot of folks who read the book, and it certainly was a surprise to me to learn as much as I did about Howard Smith. He was a segregationist congressman from Virginia who opposed the 64 Civil Rights Act, not just Title VII, which, as we know, was a bill that came out of years of agitation by African Americans for civil rights. And incongruously, he had, even though he was against the law, he had a long history of working with advocates for the Equal Rights Amendment, the National Women's Party. He was a supporter of that amendment. And so when it became clear that the bill was going to pass and it only had protection for race along with national origin and color and religion, but not sex when it came to employment discrimination, those Equal Rights Amendment advocates went to Smith and pressured him to add a sex amendment.
Why was he such an ardent supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment? Not that it wasn't a great idea, but how did he get attached to that?
It's hard to know exactly where that affiliation came about, but the organization, the National Women's Party, that was in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment was more upper class, white, and more kind of sort of mirrors a lot of the splits, actually, you see throughout the book in the feminist community of a little more upper class, maybe more intellectual, as opposed to women who were working on the ground with women workers and seeing what abuse they were going through, union advocates and so forth, people like Frances Perkins. So it's hard to know exactly what drew him to the issue. It could have even been something as craven as wanting to free up women's labor to work in the southern factories that he was representing. But in any event, he did propose the sex amendment, which was met, as you suggested in your introduction, with a lot of hilarity as if it was a joke. But after a few folks, both on both sides of Title VII, supporters and opponents, had a good laugh over it, finally Martha Griffiths from Michigan stood up and said something along the lines of, if there was any doubt about whether women were second-class citizens, I'll bet this laughter would have confirmed it. So she helped lead a cadre of, there were only 12 women in the House of Representatives in 1964, and she led a cadre of roughly five who got up and spoke really movingly and authoritatively about the kinds of barriers that women were facing on the job. The 63 Equal Pay Act had been passed the prior year, of course, but equal pay was just one part of the puzzle.
What did the American labor force look like in the early 60s when the Civil Rights Act was up for debate?
Very segregated in terms of the jobs that men and women did, and women comprised only about 30% of the workforce. Today, they're roughly half. And very few mothers were in the workforce. Those were disproportionately women of color. White women were more likely to stay home from work once they had kids. But it was a very striated workforce. There were what were called state protective laws in all of the states, and that was really what governed women's work workplace activities as of 1964. And they had been enacted to some extent for sexist reasons to keep women, you know, more tethered to the home and less competitive for wages with men. But also many, many women's advocates had argued for these laws in the late 19th century and early 20th century because the labor movement as we know it now didn't really exist yet. We didn't have the Fair Labor Standards Act keeping people's hours at a reasonable number, and wages weren't regulated. And so conditions, if you were a woman working in any sort of assembly line or agricultural business, were very, very poor. So there were these state protective laws that, as the name would suggest, were intended to protect women from certain abuses. So limiting them to 8 to 10 hours of work, barring them from overtime, barring them from carrying weights that were too heavy, and so forth. And while these were well-meaning restrictions, and they were restrictions that were later made universal with, you know, things like OSHA and the Fair Labor Standards Act, they did, of course, have the ancillary effect of keeping women seen as second-class citizens within the workplace. They couldn't get the overtime hours. They couldn't get the supervisory jobs that required them to work nights. So they were in very confined roles.
So I picked this book up expecting to enjoy it, and I did. But I have to tell you, there were so many things that made me so angry and just caused my jaw to drop. Title VII also created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to enforce its provisions. For a long time, though, the people in charge at the EEOC treated sex discrimination complaints as frivolous.
Yeah, they had a lot in common with Howard Smith and his friends on the floor of the House. Because the quote-unquote sex amendment was added somewhat at the last minute, there certainly was floor debate and there certainly had been history of debate about women's role in the workplace. But having it be part of Title VII, this law that the EEOC was charged with enforcing, came as a bit of a surprise to the leadership. They considered this predominantly a race discrimination statute, and their job was to outlaw race discrimination in employment. And this sex thing was kind of a distraction. And there are some really juicy quotes from the first commissioner of the EEOC was Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr., who, when asked at a press conference by a reporter about the sex provision, the reporter said, "Well, what about sex?" And FDR Jr. said, "Don't get me started. I'm all for it." And another executive director of the agency a few years later declared the sex provision a fluke that was born out of wedlock. Yet another leader assured reporters that he didn't believe that a man would ever have to hire a male secretary. So there was real confusion, if not outright hostility, to this mission. But it's interesting you started with the anecdote about your grandmother.
My grandmother. Mm-hmm.
Because as has been documented in some other places, most notably Gail Collins' book, flight attendants were among the very first people knocking down the door of the EEOC. And in the first year of the agency's existence, a full one-third of the charges brought were brought by women, and many of them were by these flight attendants who, as you noted, were burdened with all sorts of restrictions designed to basically, you know, keep them as eye candy for the airline's customers as opposed to just making sure the flight was safe. And it wasn't until the late 60s that the EEOC finally put out a guidance. And that's what it was limited to doing in its early years, by the way. It wasn't allowed to sue, file lawsuits until 1972 when the law was amended. So in the early years, it would put out these guidances or give advisory opinions to employers. And it wasn't until the late 60s, under a lot of pressure from the few women who worked inside the agency as attorneys, they finally put out rules saying, okay, you can't fire flight attendants for getting married or fire them for gaining a few pounds or fire them when they got pregnant. But it was a really strange world that people like your grandmother lived in, that apparently airline executives would scan the marriage notices, the wedding notices, to try to figure out if anyone was actually breaking the rules.
She was so sad to leave her job that she said if she would run into like a colleague at the grocery store, she would turn the other way because she felt like she had nothing fun to say. I mean, she went on to have a very happy life, but she loved working.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and that was the thing that drew me to this book. Work is, and draws me to this work just generally that I do. Work is such a fundamental part of our existence for people who do work outside the home, and it's part of your identity. It's how you not only put food on the table, but it's where you get your sense of purpose in the world and self-worth. And even if you're flipping burgers, it's maybe not existentially satisfying, but the satisfaction of punching the clock and getting a wage and taking care of your family and doing things well, that's a really basic human impulse. And very few of the women in this book were looking to be, you know, president of the United States or take on very high level positions. They just wanted to keep their jobs.
What did the EEOC's early negligence have to do with the formation of the National Organization for Women?
Yeah, so there was a lot of anger in the women's community around, such as it was at the time. It wasn't very, hadn't coalesced in a very organized way. But to the extent that there were women around the country, women attorneys, women in government, women's advocates who were excited about Title VII's promise, the agency's neglect and ridicule was extremely distressing. And the agency was not necessarily stalling on giving opinions on women's issues, but was giving opinions all over the map about pregnancy and what employers could and couldn't do. And as I said, we're taking a long time to act on this issue of flight attendants. Also, want ads were segregated still at the time. You know, help wanted men, help wanted women, which plainly was designed to be ended by this statute, which said women could do any job and men could do any job. So it came out of a conference of there was a conference, and I forget the location, but it was a conference of state commissions on women's rights, of which there were a few around the country. And one of the participants in this conference was Betty Friedan, and she got a number of folks together, including Eileen Hernandez, who was an attorney within the EEOC at the time. And they wanted to form an NAACP for women. And so naturally, the desire for a group like that had been around since before the EEOC's lack of action on the law. But that was it. That was the motivating factor, or the straw that broke the camel's back, or however you'd like to put it, that really lit them on fire. And in fact, I think Betty Friedan went to court to file a writ of mandamus, which is what you do when a government entity isn't performing the job that's been designated to it by law. So that's when the National Organization for Women came about, and Lawyers for Now did represent some of the earliest women using the law, using Title VII to challenge inequities at work.
Meanwhile, around that time, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court had a policy that said he would never hire a female clerk.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it was a written policy, but he in the famous book The Brethren, there are quotes from his discussions in chambers with his clerks, where male clerks, obviously, to whom he said, I don't care about this, whatever the law says. I would never hire a woman clerk. They're so unreliable. They need to leave at a certain hour and go cook dinner for their husbands and so forth. It was gently pointed out to him that this would not be a legal position to adopt out loud. And he was very offended by the suggestion. But actually, as I document in the book, the very first Title VII case heard by the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Berger did make similar statements reflecting those ideas.
Jillian Thomas is my guest. She's senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project and author of Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, Jillian Thomas. Her new book is called Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, we'll dive in here to some of the cases that you cover in the book, all of which, at the 50,000-foot view, seem like they could have been very simply solved, but all turned out to be really complicated in the arguing, in fact. The first one you write about is Phillips v. Martin Marietta. Ida Phillips wanted to apply for a job at this place and was rejected before she started because she had little kids.
She had one daughter who was 3 years old, Grace. She had six other children who were in school. And she was just getting by as a waitress at the Donut Dinette. And she heard from a neighbor about hiring down on the Martin Marietta missile defense or missile manufacturing plant that they were hiring on the assembly line. And it was going to pay at least double what she was making and also provide benefits, which when you have seven kids, it was a huge, huge inducement to her. So she went down to the plant and the receptionist would not even give her an application, telling her that having a preschool age child for a woman disqualified you for the job. It did not disqualify you if you were a man with small children. And in fact, the neighbor who had recommended the job to her had kids that young. So she was furious, and in one of my favorite stories in the book, she went home and sat down at her kitchen table and wrote a letter to Lyndon B. Johnson. And her kids are not aware whether she knew. She passed away in 1985, so I spoke to her kids, and they didn't know if she knew exactly what Title VII was, but she certainly knew she had seen the president on TV and in the paper carrying on a lot about civil rights. And so she wrote him this impassioned letter explaining what had happened to her. And incredibly, a few weeks later, she got a letter from the White House telling her that her letter had been forwarded to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So this was 1966. And incredibly, this is one of those occasions when the agency did take the sex provision seriously and found in her favor. And that was the green light to then go to court. So she had to hire a lawyer, and the case took off from there.
Hiring a lawyer turned out to be really challenging for her. Nobody wanted to take the case.
Well, the law was just much like the EEOC was nonplussed by what sex discrimination meant or what the law was supposed to change about how everyday business occurred. A lot of lawyers didn't even know about it, or if they did, they didn't really understand it. So she went to one attorney who told her she didn't have a case and to go away. And she told, later told a newspaper reporter that a light bulb went on over her head. And she thought, well, if anybody's going to understand what this law means, it's a black attorney. Surely they've had to bring cases under this law. And so there was an African-American lawyer running for judge in her town. She was in Jacksonville running for judge. She contacted him, and his name was Earl Marshall. And he was running for judge, but was too busy with his campaign. So he said, why don't you speak to my young associate, Reese Marshall, who just started working with me. And Reese Marshall was just a couple years out of law school himself. He had done an internship at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund up in New York City, and now was down in Jacksonville. And he was mainly doing criminal defense cases. But he really liked Ida Phillips. He had been raised by a single mother, and although she was married, she was of pretty modest means and otherwise might have been like a single mother. And he felt a lot of affinity towards her, and he thought what had happened was clearly wrong. And he said he had to go back to the statute book and be sure that sex was in there. He didn't remember it ever being in there, but he reminded himself that it was, and he said, let's give it a try.
She was stymied for a time with her case because the Fifth Circuit declared that Martin Marietta's policy didn't discriminate against all women, just all women with small children.
Yeah. So the company presented evidence that its workforce was actually overwhelmingly female, just female without small children. And so they said, listen, we're hiring women right and left. We don't discriminate on the basis of sex. It's just this one category of women. And the trial court judge, and then he was affirmed by the Fifth Circuit, said, yeah, it's a reality that women are the ones who take care of little kids. And we certainly don't think that Congress ever intended to disregard that just fact of life in passing this law. And so, sure, employers are allowed to exclude categories of women like this, whom they, mothers in this case, whom they think are going to be unreliable. And they dubbed that, well, actually one of their opponents on the court, the main dissenter, Judge Brown, who was a big champion of civil rights in a variety of cases during this time frame, he dubbed this sarcastically the sex plus rule. So he was saying that the majority was saying to employers, don't just exclude all women, exclude women plus one factor. And in that way, you can insulate yourself from liability. So in this case, the plus factor was being a mother. And he said, if sex plus is allowed to stand, the act, meaning the Civil Rights Act, is dead. Because there would be ever increasing numbers of plus factors that employers could ingeniously think up to add on to protected categories under the statute. And so that's what ultimately helped Reese Marshall down in Jacksonville get the attention of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and get their firepower on his side.
All right, let's talk about the Alabama Department of Public Safety. As of 1975, they did not hire women as state troopers. What kind of plus factors did they add into their requirements for employees to keep women from getting hired?
Well, it was a different scenario from Phillips v. Martin Marietta, which was explicitly a sex exclusion, right? We're not going to hire mothers with young children. We'll hire fathers. In Alabama, both the Department of Public Safety, which is where state troopers were, and the Department of Corrections, where prison guards were hired, they had these neutral characteristics that they required for applicants, that you had to be a certain height and a certain weight to even make it through the door to be able to apply. So that's neutral. It's just like saying you have to have a high school diploma or have a driver's license. That's not an explicitly sex-based criterion, but the thresholds that they had for height and weight in both jobs disproportionately screened out women because women just, as a demographic matter, are shorter and don't weigh as much. So the case was an interesting one and somewhat tortured because it began with two plaintiffs. Brenda Meath was applying to be a state trooper, and they had the height and weight requirement, but also the head of the state troopers, Colonel Dothard, said, I don't believe women can do this job at all. So they had a de facto rule against women. And then the Department of Corrections had this rule of the height and weight requirement that was screening out women. But then midway through the litigation, they added an express sex-based obstacle saying that no woman could serve in a role that put them in close contact with a prisoner, which was really in a maximum security facility, which was really all of the jobs. So it was a case that started out being about height and weight and ended up being kind of a mix of both explicit factors and also these neutral height weight restrictions that screened women out.
And was the close contact stipulation ostensibly to protect women? Was that how it was explained?
They gave a lot of explanations. Yes, it was to protect women. It was for their own good, as you might say. But they also, very interestingly, and by they, I mean the prison officials who were deposed in the case and asked by lawyers for Kim Rawlinson, why exactly do you have these rules and what kinds of studies have you done to back them up? And the answer was they had done precisely no studies to back up whether women made good prison guards or not. The prison officials opined, though, that the inmates in these maximum security facilities would be so inflamed by seeing women that they would be compelled to attack them. And so that was not only unsafe for women, but it was unsafe for the prison environment if guards are going to be at risk for assault. And like a lot of litigation, what this came down to were a lot of facts. And the lawyers from the Southern Poverty Law Center who represented Kim Rawlinson went around the country. And, you know, this was the mid-70s, so it was still quite new to be seeing women in law enforcement, thanks to Title VII. But and I should say, by the way, Title VII didn't even apply to state employers until 1972. So this was really new in the mid-70s. But they went around to the few experts around the country, occupational experts, prison experts, who looked at this of what makes a good prison guard. And overwhelmingly, they said it's interpersonal traits, it's temperament, it's training in terms of how to respond to a crisis. And yes, there's some physical aspect to it, and taking a self-defense course and so forth is important. But there was no evidence in the few maximum security facilities around the country where women were working as guards. There was no evidence that women were any more likely to be assaulted than male guards, who were plenty assaulted by the inmates as well. But it was this specter of sexual assault that really seemed to kind of inflame the state officials and keep them hanging on to this policy.
So we've talked about some discrimination in which, you know, people argue that everybody knows ladies can't do these jobs as well as men. Another case in Los Angeles effectively penalized women for the fact that they lived longer than their male colleagues and would be a bigger drain on the pension fund.
Right. And, you know, I'll flag here as we go into the discussion of this case, the Manhart case, that already there's a common theme emerging. And I saw it throughout all of the cases in the book, which is Title VII was used to break down stereotypes, to force employers to rely on individual characteristics rather than group characteristics. I'm sure there are plenty of women who are not strong enough or agile enough or smart enough to be prison guards, but you're going to have to develop criteria that actually measure for the job, not just their height and weight, for instance. Same thing with Martin Marietta. There might be some parents, mothers and fathers, who are unreliable because of their child care obligations, but you deal with that particular employee's problems. You don't generalize to the entire group. And that's what was at issue in the Manhart case, which was decided by the Supreme Court just the year after the Dothard v. Rawlinson case, the prison case. And it involved the Los Angeles City Department of Water and Power, which was one of the city's largest employers, and its engineering force had been unionized for quite some time through the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. But there was a unionization drive afoot to unionize the clerical workers, who were disproportionately women. And an extremely feisty and smart and strategic union organizer named Ruth Blanco found out from the women who worked there that there was this rule in place that because actuarial tables showed that women lived as a group longer than men, that they were required to contribute more while employees to the pension fund. There are different kinds of pensions, but this was one where the employees and the employer contributed while the worker was still on the job into a pot of money, and then it got paid out to them in a defined benefit when they retired. And so because women were presumed to have many more years of retirement ahead of them, they were required to pay 15% more out of each paycheck into the pension fund, regardless of their other risk factors, regardless of whether there was no cancer in their family and they didn't smoke and they didn't drink and they or whether there was and they might actually live a very short life. And similarly, there was no such evaluation done for men. Men just across the board paid less, no matter what their medical factors. So the union ended up taking it on in part as an effort to attract women members, ironically. But ultimately, it was successful, and the rule was struck down with very vigorous language from the Supreme Court, saying that even if a stereotype about a group is true, in this case, longevity, Title VII is about treating employees as individuals, and an individual paycheck can't be diminished every single week just because there's some hypothetical longer retirement period ahead of that particular woman.
And sure enough, within a few years, a lot of states were redoing their actuarial tables to be gender neutral, sex neutral.
Yep, that's right. And there was a kind of a bookend to the Manhart case, which was decided in 78. In 1983, a woman who worked in Arizona, she worked for I think a public utility in Arizona, brought a case that was kind of a bookend to Manhart, which was that people paid different amounts into their pensions, but then when women, or they paid, excuse me, a defined benefit into their pension, but then when it came time to collect benefits during their retirement, women got lower monthly payments. Precisely because of the same assumption that they were going to live longer. So they didn't pay more out of their paychecks up front while they were working, but they got less every month as a retiree. And the Supreme Court said, if you can't charge them more at the front end, you can't pay them less at the back end.
Were there professional risks, Jillian, to attorneys who took early cases seeking relief under Title VII?
I don't recall hearing that from any of the people I spoke to. There were risks to the women who were standing up for themselves. I mean, the women in Alabama in the mid 70s who were trying to be troopers and prison guards. I mean, Brenda Meath, the one who was trying to be a trooper, had a cross burned on her lawn. She had rocks thrown at her car. But even aside from the public, the public acrimony, people's families were of ranging levels of supportiveness. People didn't always understand why it was so important to take on in this very public way a particular wrong. And women have been socialized to sit back and abide by the rules and be good girls and not raise their voices. And filing a lawsuit is a very, it's raising your voice. So Kim Rawlinson spoke especially meaningfully to me about feeling very isolated within her family growing up in the South and hearing the N-word all around her used very, very casually, and then deciding that for her, she was going to stand up and say that this rule wasn't right. And she said she got a lot of pushback from her parents, who said, they must have the rules for a reason. Why are you, bringing ignominy on the family? And she says she just stopped bringing it up at a certain point. It wasn't worth it.
Jillian Thomas is my guest. She's senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project and author of Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jillian Thomas, who is senior staff attorney with the ACLU's Women's Rights Project and author of Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Jillian, as you deftly point out here, sexual harassment, the thing, has likely existed as long as women have worked outside the home. When did it become something that we called sexual harassment and recognized as such?
That was one part of the book I really enjoyed, because it was a time of delving back into some history that, frankly, I wasn't that familiar with. But the name itself came out of a group of women who were working at Cornell University in 1975, who had started working with women on campus who had experienced sexual harassment. And actually, a lot of the early sexual harassment claims came out of women who were denied unemployment. They left a job because the harassment was so bad, or they were fired because they rebuffed advances, and then they applied for unemployment and were denied because it was considered a voluntary quit. So out of this effort to help these women on the campus, these feminist activists at at Cornell started convening conferences. They convinced, at the time, Eleanor Holmes Norton was the head of the New York City Commission on Human Rights, and she held hearings. So some momentum was building around this concept. At the same time, women in the court system were trying to use the sex provision in Title VII, which says nothing about sexual harassment. It just says discrimination because of sex. So what's that? And the women who were bringing these cases predominantly were bringing them in the scenario of supervisor makes advances, advances are rebuffed, employee is fired. And so very slowly but surely, women did start to get some acknowledgement that this was illegal, because courts could understand that if it was hurting your wallet, ultimately, if you were getting fired because of this conduct, then maybe it was discrimination. But what was really perplexing to the courts, and what was so ultimately significant about the 1986 case that's profiled in the book, Meritor Savings Bank v. Vinson, is that is when the recognition of a hostile environment as discriminatory came into the lexicon, where you, as in the case of Ms. Vinson, had endured 3 years of horrific sexual abuse, much of it, frankly, a lot of the behavior was criminal that was going on. But her position at the bank had actually never suffered. She'd never suffered what you might call a tangible loss of benefits. Her environment was just heavily polluted with this awful abusive talk and touch and leering and ultimately assault. And the Supreme Court said, that's equally discriminatory as if you said, I'm firing you because you didn't accept this advance. They drew, interestingly, on the context of racial harassment, which courts didn't have any problem understanding that if an employee is called the N-word by a supervisor or by coworkers, or if a noose is hung over that person's workstation, that is harassment because of race. Though sexual harassment for a while was dismissed as some sort of personal proclivity of a supervisor, just clumsy courting, ultimately it was recognized that your environment can be a discriminatory environment too.
So the idea was that it wasn't on the woman to quit to prove that there had been some kind of damage done.
Right, right. And I have a subsequent case in the book that refined the standard for finding liability in sexual harassment, because, of course, what was happening to Michelle Vinson, as I mentioned, was criminal activity. And so it was, in a way, not a hard decision for the court to make that was the standard that they came up with is severe or pervasive conduct that creates an abusive working environment. Well, obviously, that line had been crossed with her. But what about someone who is never touched, for instance? The harassment is just verbal. It's, not ugly like a leer, but it's complimentary. So how bad does it have to be? Does that kind of conduct have to be before it's considered severe or pervasive and creates an abusive environment? And so the case of Teresa Harris, who's now Teresa Wilson, but at the time Teresa Harris, clarified that where she had managed to function in the face of this barrage of harassment by her supervisor, who was also the manager of the company, who in addition to harassing her sexually through doing things like coming up, to her and jangling coins in his pocket and saying, "Do you want to get a quarter out of my pocket?" Or, throwing pens on the floor and asking people to pick them up and, things like that. He also denigrated her. She was a high-level manager at the company, the only high-level woman manager. And he would say, "What does a dumbass woman like you know? Shut up. You don't know anything." So it was harassment that was not sexual in terms of making overtures, but just sex-based. You're a dumbass woman. We need a man in your job, but it was quite hostile. So the big gain from that, and it was very high stakes in that case, because if the court had ruled against Teresa Harris and said, no, it's only if you have a nervous breakdown or if the environment is so bad you're forced to quit, or otherwise set the bar very, very high for what's illegal, so much of the other conduct that we know goes on that is demeaning and holds women back, makes them not want to advance within a company or work closely with a harasser, all the various ways that harassment demeans you as a woman in the workplace, or a man if it's happening to a man, that would have been fair game. But thankfully, in her case, the court did say the words were that Title VII comes into play before an employee has a nervous breakdown. So it was not a very clear scientific standard, but the standard that they put in that case to add on to the prior Vinson one of severe or pervasive that creates an abusive work environment, it was that creates an abusive work environment for a reasonable person. So would a reasonable person consider this abusive? And that's obviously inexact, but it at least sort of rules out the most thin-skinned, idiosyncratic of among us from creating a federal case, so to speak, out of harassment.
Some cases have been really interesting because the issue has been that women have been prevented from progressing in their careers because they didn't behave the way their male supervisors and colleagues thought they should behave.
Yeah. Well, this is another one of those, right, of stereotypes being busted. And that's why Title VII was so important. It broke down these barriers about what jobs women are suited for, what kinds of women can work, i.e., you know, mothers. And then with the Pricewaterhouse v. Hopkins case, this was really one of the most monumental, I think, of all Title VII jurisprudence, and certainly in the book. Anne Hopkins was a very successful consultant at what was then one of the big eight accounting firms, Pricewaterhouse. She was on a partnership track, bringing in millions and millions of dollars of business. And she came up for partner. She had the unanimous support of her department. She had a bigger book of business than any of the men who were up. And there were 87 men and her who came up for review. And she was not outright denied, but was told that her candidacy was being deferred to the following year. And the only thing she had to go on were the comments that were written down by all the managers who were on the promotion committee. And none of them had to do with the money that she had brought in or how she did her job. They were all about her personality. And it was not just her personality. It was in very gendered terms. So one partner described her as macho. Another described her as overcompensating for being a woman. Another said she needs a course at charm school. And then when she went to her biggest mentor within her department and said, what do I have to do? How am I going to make partner next time? Or how do I fix this for next time around for a different result? And he said, well, and this is someone who supported her. He said, why don't you walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, style your hair, and wear jewelry? And that's what she was told she had to do to make partner. It's nothing about her actual job performance. So the case is tremendously important, not only because of the ultimate result when the court agreed that this kind of stereotyping of how a woman or a man, for that matter, and it's certainly been how it's been interpreted since then, how anybody acts and whether they're conforming to the sex stereotype that prevails about them, so that women are supposed to be feminine and soft and men are supposed to be tough and take charge, and a failure to conform to that and taking an adverse action because of that is discriminatory. It's, in other words, if they're denying you partnership for being the wrong kind of woman, it's as if they said, we're denying you partnership because you're a woman. It's indistinguishable. It's both are sex discrimination. The other reason the case was so fascinating was because it's the first case that I'm aware of in which a social psychologist played an expert testimonial role. A very young social psychologist at Carnegie Mellon named Susan Fisk was contacted by Anne Hopkins' attorneys and worked with them to develop and testified, but also did a report explaining this concept of stereotyping and how reflective it was of sex bias, and that played a role in the case all the way to the Supreme Court.
I'm always so curious when I read about a successful lawsuit like this, what it's like when the person actually returns to the job they had been denied or given the promotion they have sought. What was it like for Ann Hopkins to go back to Pricewaterhouse?
Yeah, you're right. And I think I'm scanning my memory, but I think she's the only person who ended up going back to work who had been off the job. There are, I guess, a couple cases in the book where the women stayed on the job the whole time and continued working there while the case was going on. But she is a really formidable woman. And the way she put it to me was the people who didn't like me in the first place still didn't like me. And the people who had always liked me still liked me. And she was very daunted to go back. She had fought for 7 years to be there. And I should say, by the way, that was another noteworthy thing about this case. It was the first time a federal court had awarded as a remedy not just lost wages that she had been deprived of during the years of the litigation, that she wasn't a partner, a highly compensated partner, but he also put her in the job as partner, which was a first. So it was very strange for her because the people who had been in her class going up for partner had, by that point, advanced quite ahead. And so she was sort of starting over again at this very junior level. But she stayed on for another decade. And she ended up leaving because of some mechanics, at least as she describes it, some mechanics that in the changes that were being made to the retirement plan. And she decided to get out while the getting was good. And so she left for reasons completely unrelated to the work environment. But one thing also that I think was quite striking, and I think I've seen happen a lot with my clients, is that it did sort of radicalize her. Mm. At the time this happened to her, when she was denied partnership, she had never thought about the women's movement. She had never thought about being whether she was a feminist or not. Even though she had a lot of the characteristics that I think a lot of us would consider feminist characteristics. And she had no idea that the law of Title VII even applied to her. And she certainly had never looked around and thought how women were doing at Pricewaterhouse. And they were doing among the worst of any of the big eight accounting firms. When she went back, 8 years later, she took it upon herself. She really had nothing to lose, right? So she took it upon herself to be sort of a squeaky wheel in terms of advocating for all kinds of diversity, not just gender diversity, but racial and ethnic diversity as well. And she, in our interview, I was really struck by how she could cite the names of all of the people whom she had shepherded to partnership and mentored and how diverse they were.
How much is Title VII in use today in bringing lawsuits against employers alleged to have been discriminating according to sex?
Oh, it's
daily.
I keep trying to think of a better term besides big kahuna, which it's the main vehicle for, I'm a women's rights lawyer. Every person who gives me a call, I'm using Title VII, and not just Title VII, but these cases, which is why I wanted to write the book, is that in my daily life, I was citing Price Waterhouse in, especially at the time when I had the idea for the book, I was representing a lot of women firefighters and cops and construction workers. So talk about people who are bucking stereotypes. And I was frequently in my advocacy using Price Waterhouse, using Johnson Controls, another case in the book about women in pregnancy, using the Meritor sexual harassment case and the later Harris sexual harassment case. It's absolutely our bread and butter. These cases have become part of the language that we speak, just in terms of when anyone thinks of, any woman thinks of, what are my rights at work? She's thinking about Title VII mostly. Hmm. And it's the main vehicle by which we assure sexual equality in the workplace.
Jillian,
so I wanted to pay tribute to the women who made that happen.
Jillian Thomas is senior staff attorney with the ACLU Women's Rights Project and author of the book Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases, and 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Jillian, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.